Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Good afternoon. I'm Megan Lynch, and I am sitting in with you for the next 2 hours. Maybe we should just call this show Things That Sparked My Interest this week. As I was looking through some of the stories that were out, we've got a mix of things that are pretty serious and some things that are a little bit lighter to think about. And hopefully over the next 2 hours, you can join us on the phone lines as we discuss some of these topics. One of the things that we're going to look at, and this is going to come up a little bit later, is a new technology that Domino's Pizza is using to ensure quality control. And I want to introduce this a little bit. We'll get into this in the next hour. But apparently Domino's, not in the United States yet, but in, I believe it's Australia and New Zealand, they are actually using workplace surveillance to make sure that the quality of their pizzas is up to snuff. But yeah, basically, they're using cameras and artificial intelligence, AI, to make sure that their employees are putting the right things in the right amounts on your order of pizza. Now, on the face of it, it sounds like, yeah, this is great quality control. And basically what they're saying is, listen, we're not going to punish employees who make mistakes, but this is just a way for us to increase quality. I'm wondering, like, for $10 a pizza, how they afford to do this. But there are some individuals that are bringing up some concerns about this technology. If this is just another way to have surveillance on your employees, and if this is in any way violates their privacy. And so coming up a little bit later, we're going to speak with an attorney who handles employment law and talk to him on both sides of this, not only from the perspective of the employee and what it means for them and what questions they need to ask about this, but also the perspective of the employer. Do they have a right to do this? How far can they take this kind of thing? And for us to be thinking, is artificial intelligence going to be part of what happens in the workplace as far as reviewing our performance? So that, I think we'll talk about that coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. Another story we're going to talk about has to do with recycling and responsible use. And this is a story much closer to home out of Edwardsville, Illinois. You may have heard the reports this week that Edwardsville has approved fees for paper and plastic bag use in their stores. So basically, starting next spring, if you go into any of the big box stores in Edwardsville, now this does not apply to some of the smaller mom and pop shops that they have in Edwardsville, which they have quite a few of those, but the bigger stores like the Kohl's and the grocery stores and things like that that are in Edwardsville, for every bag that you use at the checkout, paper or plastic, there's going to be a 10-cent fee imposed on the use of that. And the thought is, of course, to encourage people to bring their own bags. The interesting part of this is not necessarily considered a tax because it's not in any way going to go back to Edwardsville. In fact, the money is going to stay with those retailers. And number one, the thought is that it will help them implement this because obviously there's probably some changes that they're going to have to make in their systems to be able to charge this 10-cent fee per bag. But also that maybe it will encourage these stores as well to use some of those funds that they have coming in to maybe actually purchase reusable bags that they can hand out to their customers. So we're going to speak with one of the Edwardsville council members that pushed for this and helped get this passed just about why this is important. If they are worried that there's going to be any backlash to this, that people won't want to shop in Edwardsville because they might have to pay extra for bags, or if what they've heard from stores, we'll cover that. And again, I think we're going to bring that up in the second hour that we talk in the 2 o'clock hour this afternoon. What we're going to take on coming up in just a little bit is a pretty serious issue. An article that came out this week, a report from the Centers for Disease Control that is really alarming. And if you have young people in your life, kids, teenagers, young adults, I think you'll want to sit up and listen to this and really think about what's going on with our young people. The CDC did a 10-year study, and basically what they found is that the youth suicide rate has increased 56% in a decade. Between 2007 and 2017, The suicide rate among people ages 10 to 24 years old climbed 56%. Now, at the same time, the homicide rate for individuals of that age went down a little bit, increased a little bit, but it's still lower than what it was. And so now what we have actually is a situation where the chances of a person in this age range, 10 to 24, dying by suicide is greater than homicide. It used to be the reverse. Now, we don't want either, obviously, but I think we need to look at what is going on for these young people, that these suicide rates are high and climbing. Here's what I found really disturbing when you break down the numbers a little bit. When you look at that age group of 10 to 14-year-olds, now, granted, they still had by far the lowest rate of suicides, but the rate of suicide in that age group nearly tripled from 2007 to 2017. Now, having a child in that age range, of course, that got my interest. You may have kids that are near those ages or grandkids. And so I think it's worth a discussion about what is going on in the lives of these young people that they would think that life is not worth living anymore. And what really, I had seen this article after we had made a visit to one of the local children's hospitals here with one of my children who is around that age. And they were asking him some questions before we got some routine stuff done. And the last question that they asked him, and they told me, we don't ask this of anyone unless they're 8 years or older. The last question they asked was, have you ever thought of harming yourself? And he answered it very honestly, no, you know, and it didn't even bat an eye at it. But for me, it gave me a lot of pause to think that they were even asking kids this. And obviously, they're asking kids this because it's becoming a bigger issue. So coming up next, I reached out to Tina Meyer, who lost her daughter, Megan, to suicide after incidents of cyberbullying. I'm sure the name will be very familiar to some of you. And so we are going to talk to her next and get her perspective on the issue of young people committing suicide. We'll be back next. KMOX News Time is 1:15. Welcome back. I'm Megan Lynch with you on this Sunday afternoon. So glad you could join us. And this hour, we are talking about a really serious topic, but I think it's one that, while it may be a little uncomfortable to talk about, it's something that needs to be talked about. And it's the rate of youth suicide, which the CDC says increased 56% in a decade. And we're talking about, when we talk about youth suicide, we're talking about young people ages 10 to 24 years old. And again, that rate climbed 56% between 2007 and 2017. So when I saw this article this week, this got my attention for sure. And so I decided to reach out to the Megan Meyer Foundation. Megan, of course, was a young woman who took her own life following a cyberbullying hoax by an adult neighbor who was posing as a fictitious boy on MySpace. And the foundation has now grown into a global bullying and cyberbullying prevention foundation. They do a lot of education, prevention, and intervention. And so I reached out to the foundation, and lo and behold, the person that answered the phone was Tina Meyer. So today we're talking with Tina Meyer, founder of the Megan Meyer Foundation. Unfortunately, we have to come to you to talk about this topic. It is still an incredibly huge issue, and it sounds like from these recent reports that have been done that the youth suicide rate continues to increase. You know, as you have devoted yourself to this effort, what do you see going on with young people that you think might be contributing to these numbers?
You know, I am certainly not a doctor in this field, but with the youth that we work with and traveling around the country, what we're seeing is higher rates of anxiety, depression, access to mental health needs, and really the stigma with mental health. We know that they are dealing with a lot of issues with social media, the stress and pressure that it's putting on them that sometimes they don't even realize. And so when reports like this come out from the CDC and you see this increase of 56%, you know, your heart kind of drops because you see all of these things happening, but we always hope that the more talk and awareness and education is creating change, and we're seeing that we have a lot more work to do.
Let's talk about that social media angle. Unfortunately, you know that all too well because of what happened to your lovely daughter, Megan. where do you see social media falling in this now, and the risks involved with social media for young people?
You know, what we're seeing is that, again, it's not this, we've always heard the word cyberbullying. So we know that when somebody is directly attacking you online, sending messages, videos, we know those. But what we're seeing is happening is when they're online, they're scrolling and they're not invited someplace. It's not that they're being excluded on purpose, but maybe they're not invited, or they see friends that are doing something fun with their family, and maybe they don't have that family dynamic. Maybe they're seeing some happiness in another, you know, post, and theirs isn't as good, or they're getting more likes. And all of these things that we see every day as we're scrolling through, and it seems as though everybody else has it together. Everybody's life is good. They're getting what they want. And then it starts making us feel less than. We're not keeping up. We're not doing good enough. And we don't verbalize that to everybody. We kind of take it in, and that taking that in on top of not being able to verbalize can really be hard. And so we talk to kids a lot about, you know, realizing, like, take that phone, put it down for just 5 minutes, take a deep breath. I don't care if you need to go take a walk, if you need to grab something to eat, if you need to draw, listen to music, shoot hoops. Do something for 5 minutes and tell yourself, I'm not comparing myself to everybody else. I am me. And sometimes trying to reset, because even adults get in that where we start feeling less than. So we do see that emotional struggle that they're dealing with, and those are concerns.
Well, Tina, that's just what I was going to say. When you were describing that, I thought, well, yes, we all do that in a lot of ways. And I do think that when we look at social media, especially maybe Facebook and some of those pages where we see what we think are people doing all these amazing things all the time, and they've got all these activities, I can see for someone who might not have the maturity of an adult that they wouldn't really be able to handle that.
Right. I mean, it is really hard. It's because in their world, right, you know, their brains are not developed. So everything is like an immediate reaction. So they don't see tomorrow as much. And they don't see that in time things can get better. It immediately feels like, well, I'm excluded, or I don't have enough likes, or I must not be pretty enough, or all of these things. And it starts all pressuring up, feeling like they are the ones. It's about me, and why me? And so what we really try to do is, one, identify that with kids and get them to understand that even though they may not be directly cyberbullied, that when these things do come up, these are real feelings, and that we do have to understand that first before then we can learn to be able to sometimes take a step away. Just, and I'm not saying get rid of social media, that's not realistic, but sometimes being able to take a deep breath. I don't care if they like yoga, meditation, running, playing with their dog, whatever it may be, that 5 minutes just to take some deep breaths, reset, and remind themselves. And so we're really trying to make sure that we get that out there for them.
I think one of the parts of the CDC study that was disturbing for me especially was when they looked at some of the younger kids, 10 to 14 year olds. While they had the lowest rate of suicide, that rate had nearly tripled in a decade from 2007 to 2017. Do you see those same kind of trends as you travel and you research?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, it's every time we're hearing about it, and again, with social media and with media, we are hearing more about this. I think the concerns in that age group is middle school, those are the toughest years that kids have. And I think it's hard for parents to talk about these hard words such as suicide to their kids when you've got a 10-year-old and you think they should just be playing outside and they shouldn't have to worry about all these big things happening in the world. But the reality is that we do have to, when it's age appropriate, talk to them in the correct terms, the correct ways. And the reason a lot of parents are always concerned, thinking that if we do talk about this, maybe that's going to put it in their head. So maybe that's a bad thing. That's not the reality. That is not what all the studies show. What we want to do is not do scare tactics. We want to be able to explain to them about real situations, what are some signs, where to go, and making sure that they know that they have people to go to, mom, dad, aunt, uncle, a teacher, a counselor, somebody at their church, calling the National Suicide Prevention Line. So we want to give them many places to be able to reach out and know that their voice matters. But we do see these kids at this age, and they always say that there are signs, and it's not as impulsive. Suicide's not just a one-time situation, and they take their own lives. But we certainly see in this age group that they don't have a lot of coping skills, and they don't have a lot of ways of understanding what the after effects are going to be, and that many times they will say they just want the pain to stop. And so we have to be able to let them know that we hear the pain they're going through is real, but then there is help. And so through that pain, we can now get to this place and we can work together.
You're listening to Tina Meyer, founder of the Megan Meyer Foundation. We're talking about the report from the CDC that came out this week saying the youth suicide rate increased 56% in a decade. That's for young people ages 10 to 24. When we come back, we're going to talk to Tina more about the conversations that we should be having with our kids. And welcome back. This is KMOX Weekend at Your Service. I'm Megan Lynch, sitting in with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon here on KMOX. We've been talking about a pretty serious subject, and it is the youth suicide rate. It increased 56% in the decade between 2007 and 2017. This report from the CDC saying in 2017, suicide was the second leading cause of death among those ages 10 to 24, behind unintentional injuries such as car crashes or drug overdoses. And in that time, in that decade, suicide overtook homicide deaths among young people. It's all terrible. And we're back with Tina Meyer. As you heard before the break, Tina, you're encouraging us to have these important conversations with our kids. Let's talk about what that conversation might sound like in more detail, because I was shocked this very week for one of my own children. We were at a medical appointment, something very routine. And one of the questions that was asked, and I was told it was asked of any child over the age of 8, have you ever thought of harming yourself? And I was so shocked by the question. And I thought, right, wow, you know, for my child who is that middle school age, you know, how would I open up that conversation without scaring him and without planting things in his mind? How do you open that up?
I think kids are very smart, and they're smarter than sometimes we give them credit for. Because when they are your child and they are young and it feels like they are more naive, we don't want to burst that bubble. We want to keep them in that safe and naive place. But the reality is we have to talk to them. So I think, one, it's for parents to get educated on what is the difference between self-harm, what is the difference between signs of suicide, somebody who has thoughts of suicide versus somebody who is actually has a plan and who has these suicidal ideations or is going to make an attempt. There are many different things. And so I think going to websites and educating themselves is one really important. I think when they sit down with kids, it's really talking to them and saying, listen, I don't have all of the answers, and these topics are kind of hard to talk about, but I want to make sure that you know that we are here and that there are questions that you may need to have. And so let's talk about the word suicide. Do you know what the word suicide is and what it means? And see what they say. If they do, and most likely they're going to, those are things that you can say, okay, now do you know what you would do if you ever had thoughts? And those are going to be hard questions to ask as a parent. You're going to probably have to practice them several times, and you may be shaky asking that because you don't want the answer. And so if they say, you know, you say, listen, have you ever had thoughts of self-harming, or have you ever had thoughts of suicide? And see what they say. And then you can ask them if they say, no, but sometimes I don't want to be here anymore. Okay. And I hear you, because you want to listen and you want to validate. I hear that you say you don't want to be here anymore. And what are those times? And, you know, what does that feel like? And when you say you don't want to be here, have you had any thoughts of an actual plan? And so you want to be able to, because you don't want to, in one way, you don't want to say, oh my gosh, do you have a gun and have you done this and have you done that? You don't want to do that and scare them. But you do want to make sure that if they've ever had thoughts, if they've ever had a plan, you do want to ask them those questions, because you want to be able to see where they're at, letting them know that you will listen to them, because they know that this word scares us. And so sometimes we try to shut it down. So if you actually listen, validate how hard that could be to tell you, and that you really value them opening up and talking to you about it, and that together we're going to get some help. We're going to talk to somebody so that we can now work through some of these things that you're working through. You can also even bring up and say, you know, if you're scared of saying, have you ever had thoughts of suicide? Maybe even break it in with ways of, do you know of anybody that has talked about suicide or has attempted suicide at your school that you may be concerned about? And what are those concerns? And, you know, what have they said? Because sometimes we can use it in a way of kind of doing it if they know of somebody else. And then you can say, okay, you know, have you ever had those thoughts? And then I think it's just making sure that we give them then these correct answers. If they're at a certain age, middle school and up, you can say, you know, I want to share with you Megan's story. Have you ever heard of this story? And this is why, as a mom or a parent, I want to talk to you about these issues, because there is help out there and there are many things that we can do, but we need to work together. And so I think a lot of times it's just that conversation. It's going to be hard, but I'm telling you, it's going to be worth it. And if we can get to this early enough and get them the right help, then we can start seeing these decreasing.
Now, Tina, for you, of course, you launched the Megan Meyer Foundation in 2007, a year after your own daughter took her life. Tell us a little bit more about your mission there and how people can get in touch with you.
Sure. So our mission is pretty simple. It is to support and inspire actions to end bullying, cyberbullying, and suicide. And through that, we do a lot of preventative programs. And so we travel all over the country and go into schools providing programs for students and educators and parents. We also do interactive workshops in the St. Louis area to be able to really help kids identify these issues, look at ways that they can try to solve them, try to make a difference within their own school, so that then they can go back and make a sustainable difference. And so those have been phenomenal. And we also have a resource center that we take calls, emails from people all over the world, and we'll provide them support and resources to be able to help them through some of the situations they're going through, many times with their kids. You know, anybody can contact us. Our office number is 636-757-3501, or you can go to our website, which is meganmeyerfoundation.org, and it's meganmeierfoundation.org.
Tina, thank you so much for your time and your perspective today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That is Tina Meyer, the founder of the Megan Meyer Foundation, joining us today on KMOX. When we come back, we're going to talk about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Welcome back. I'm Megan Lynch, and thank you for listening on this Saturday afternoon. Well, this week on KMOX, we focused on ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Brian Kelly got to meet with one of those people.
As we meet ordinary people doing extraordinary things here on KMOX, I am sitting with one of them, the Reverend Lisa Williams, and we are at the Thrive Church in Granite City. And Lisa, you are responsible for figs and twigs and feeding a lot of people. Tell me about all the things that you're doing here in Granite City.
Well, it all started with the FIGS program back in 2009, which is a seniors program that meets the second and fourth Thursdays of every month. They get a meal, we do a devotion, we celebrate birthdays, we have speakers, musical guests. It's just really a time to try to pull the seniors outside of their homes and allow them to be in fellowship and share a meal with others.
And so that was the first project you started. How did that come about?
There really was a hole here in Granite City in 2009 as far as seniors were concerned. So the church I was serving at the time decided that they would take this piece on. So on Thanksgiving Day of 2009 was our first FIGS meeting, so to speak. On that Thanksgiving, we had a total of four people join us.
You started with a few. How many did you have today?
We had just short of 100 with us today. We were just gifted new property, which allows us, that where we've been holding it until about 3 months ago, 100 was our top number. So we are now able to probably about 2.5 to 3 times that size. So we are encouraging our senior community to start inviting their friends. My goal is that within a year, this place will be packed and we'll be out of room again. For me, that's a good problem.
And so that's the FIGS program, but you also have TWIGS. What's that?
TWIGS began 2 years later, and that's a childhood hunger initiative. It began in the summer of 2011 here just in Granite City with the hopes of providing summer meals at that point. That first summer in four locations here in Granite, we did 2,513 lunches. We were very disappointed because at that point, the free and reduced lunch rate here in Granite in this school district told us that it should have been much more than that. However, what we learned a huge lesson that summer, and that is that it's all about location, because two of our locations, even though they were the right schools where the children attended, they were bused in during the school year. So getting them there in the summer wasn't going to happen. So that changed everything as far as the TWIGS program goes. Fast forward to this past summer that just ended, we were in 43 communities in both Missouri and Illinois, covering 12 counties, about 75 to 80 actual locations, and we did a total of 109,621 lunches Monday through Friday.
Reverend Lisa Williams, now you weren't just satisfied with feeding children during the week. You started a program to help them on weekends.
Correct. In 2013, the fall of 13, the school district here in Granite City came to me and said, Lisa, is there a way, after they had known and experienced the summer program a little bit, is there a way that you can help us with some kids on the weekend? So we had a couple of meetings. We piloted a program here in Granite City in two buildings. There's 9 school buildings, but we piloted it for 2 semesters in 2 of the buildings, got all the wrinkles worked out. And you now fast forward, we're currently in the program again, but last year we did a little over 34,000 bags of weekend food in 14 school districts. And again, this school year, we're back in those same 14 school districts. Again, I anticipate 30 to 35,000 bags. There's no way to know exactly, but it is just basic food. It's about 4.5 meals in a bag, and they're discreetly given to the children. All the volunteers, for instance, here in Granite, we pack every 3 Thursdays, or every 3rd Thursday. We pack about 1,000 bags. We know numbers by building, and that's what we drop in the office. The social worker, the principal, then take those bags and discreetly put them inside the backpacks. The kids are not marked. We do not want them to be marked. We don't want them to be bullied unless they self-acknowledge. And that has happened. They get excited. They want to see what they're getting in their bag, and they'll take their bag and dump them in the hallway. Then somebody knows that they're getting a bag. Here's the cool part of what we're finding and what they're relaying us, that the kids are attending. Attendance is better, especially Thursday, Friday, because they never know for sure when they're going to get their bag. And attendance on Monday is better. Kids that go hungry on the weekends won't show up at school on Monday because they're just out of the mood. I mean, if they haven't had food all weekend, who wants to go to school? So, and they've also found that the kids aren't acting out. They're not getting in trouble. They've even seen increase in grades. It's amazing what having a full belly does in the life of a child. Think about it. When you're hungry, who wants to do anything but think about the fact that you're hungry?
You obviously have a passion for this. Where does that passion, where did it come from?
I'm going to tell what has always been a private story, and I'll try to make it as quick as I can. My marriage fell apart due to my husband's childhood abuse, both physical and sexual abuse. I had gone into ministry a couple of years before that all came out. So when he left, I was still a student pastor at the time. Money was tough. So that fall, my girls were still in junior high and high school, and I had to go and register them. So I registered, and in the past, I came out of corporate America. I was a second career ministry person. So money had never been an issue because I'd always been in corporate America. But that year, it was rough. It was tough. I was a student. Craig's no longer in the picture. And school registration came, and there was a table. And at first, I walked by it, and it was the forms for the free and reduced lunch. I walked past it, I saw the sign, I turned around and I went back. And I remember standing there looking at it thinking, how in the world, how has my life come to this, that I'm struggling to feed my own two girls? So I picked it up, filled it out, and it was approved. We did not get free, but the girls got reduced. And at that time, the lunches here in the Granite City School District were $2.20 a piece, which doesn't seem like much. But it was it's $4.40 a day. With the reduce, I could get it for 65 cents each. So that was $1.30 versus $4.40. It made a difference. It helped. I understand the shame. I understand the anger. I understand the hurt. I understand the parents that say, why can't I feed my own kids? So today, anytime I'm packing a bag or I'm out in the summertime and I move between spots a lot just to talk to people and to keep my feet in the ground and to be a part of that grassroots effort, and that's really what we're doing. Every time I hand a child a bag, I see the face of my daughters. We could have, they could have been one of those Twigs children. Hunger knows no boundaries. It's in every community, bar none. It's how big is the pocket. It breaks my heart. And I really do think, looking back now, that there was a reason I struggled those years, and it was to give me this sense of empathy, this eyes to see that, childhood hunger is real. And if we don't do something about it, those kids suffer. And we're hearing the difference it makes through the weekend program from the school district officials. And what a difference it makes. And I will tell you, I would like to share one more success story. And we've had several. There was a young lady for about 3 years. Every summer, she would come to our lunch program at Triangle Park. And she would bring her little boy, and his name was Arumbalai. And Arumbalai, after middle of the first summer, he always had his lunchbox with him, and it was a Thomas the Tank Engine lunchbox, and we would put his lunch in. That third summer, Arumbalai came every day. That year at Christmas, he came for the breakfast with Santa, and when it was over, Arumbalai and his mom came over, and she looked at me and she said, "Lisa," she says, "I just want to thank you for the last 3 years." She says, "I want you to know that this will be our last time to see you because of your help in helping me stretch my budget. I was a single mom. I was a student at SIU Edwardsville. And before this December, a few days earlier, she had graduated from SIUE. She'd gotten a full-time job and was moving so that she and Arumbalai would start their lives over again. But I cried, she cried. But you know what? To be able to say that that's a success, that that 5 or 6 item lunch in the summer helped her. It gave her the means to stretch her budget and to be able to get through school. There's no better feeling than that.
Well, you're certainly Reverend Lisa Williams, an ordinary person doing extraordinary things, and the world's a better place because of it. Thank you.
Thank you for asking. Thank you.
And thank you to Brian Kelly for bringing us her story. We're going to have more of those coming up next hour. Our anchors and reporters did a whole series of them this week on ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Just a couple that you're going to get to hear next hour. An area librarian who's doing some extraordinary things, as well as a story about some Santa's helpers that Maria Kina did that I think you will find interesting as well. Also coming up next hour, we're going to talk about a couple of things going on in our community and around the world. One of those, one Illinois community is going to start charging a fee for any plastic or paper bags that you use at checkout at the big box stores in their community. We'll tell you which community that is and why we're doing that. And then after that, we're going to talk about AI in the workplace. Artificial intelligence, is it watching how you perform your job? And what are the legal ramifications, both for employees and employers? So we hope you'll join us coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. CBS News and KMOX News is coming up next. This is KMOX Weekend at Your Service. Good afternoon. I'm Megan Lynch. Thank you for joining me on this Sunday afternoon. In the next hour, we're going to talk about a few things, and we're going to revisit some of the great features that my coworkers did this week. We decided at KMOX to take a look at ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Of course, you may have heard Brian Kelly's interview last hour that he did about a special ministry focus in Granite City, Illinois. Well, coming up later on this hour, we're going to talk about some of the other ones that my coworkers interviewed. Debbie Monterey spoke with the founder of a surgical outreach for the Americas, also an extraordinary librarian that Michael Calhoun spoke with. And then Maria Kina has a fun one as well with an organization that's kind of like a Santa's helper. It's a warehouse where Christmas dreams are created. So hopefully we'll have time to get to that as well on this Sunday afternoon. A couple of topics that we're going to talk about as well. Edwardsville officials have decided that they are going to charge fees in stores for paper and plastic bag use. This is for people like me who forget all the reusable bags at home and get to the store, and then they have to buy bags. I don't know how many Ruler food bags and Aldi food bags that I have clogging up my kitchen right now that never make it back in the car because I forget to take them, and then I end up having to buy more bags when I'm there. But of course, this is wasteful. It's hard to recycle plastic bags. Paper bags is a little bit easier. But Edwardsville is hoping to encourage people to bring their own bags, stop putting these things into the waste stream. We'll see if they've gotten the cooperation of some of the big retailers that they want to have impose this. Now, this is a fee and not a tax. So we'll talk some more later this hour with one of the councilmen that's been involved in this effort to look at why they've decided to do this in particular and what they're expecting to get out of it and whether they've had any concerns posed by shoppers or stores alike. Also coming up, we're going to talk about some new technology that is being used in the workplace, and we're going to see what some of the legal ramifications of this are. You know, for most of us in the workplace, I think we're used to the fact that we know that there may be cameras when we come in and out of the front door that are watching what's going on. There are pass cards that a lot of us use, maybe to get into our workplace. So employers know when we're coming and going. They may know when we log into our computers because we each have our own personal login. You work from home, you log into a VPN maybe. They know when you're on that, when you're actually doing work and there's a stream going back and forth between your home and your workplace. Maybe they monitor your email. I think most of us probably have some kind of boilerplate language in our employee handbooks that says, yes, that our employee can figure out what we are doing online. Because guess what? That equipment belongs to our business. It does not belong to us. Well, Domino's has taken this a step further, and this is not happening in the United States as of yet, but in Australia and also in New Zealand, they have a new tool. It is called Dom Pizza Checker. And it's apparently a combination of sensors and artificial intelligence and advanced machine learning where they can actually monitor their employees to make sure that they are making your pizza correctly. Now, they're saying that this is not going to be a way to fire people or punish people who don't quite make a pizza right, but it's for quality control. And there's going to be a scorecard bonus system for their employees, I guess, who make really excellent $10 pizzas. So what's the harm in that? Well, we're going to talk with one attorney coming up next who says that technology like this should give us pause, that as both employees and employers, we really need to know what's being monitored. So that is coming up next. It's 212. An interesting article out recently about Domino's Pizza. They have introduced a tool called the Dom Pizza Checker, and basically it's artificial intelligence, sensor technology, advanced machine learning, so that they can make sure that workers are making your pizza properly. Now, on the face of it, that doesn't sound bad, but could it involve some privacy concerns for those employees? Joining us to talk more about it is Austin Pennington. He's an attorney who handles a wide range of criminal and civil cases, including employment law. And so that's why we've called on him today. Austin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
You know, on the face of it, when we look at it, we think, okay, a company is doing quality control in a very modern way. But what are the potential problems there and the potential concerns for employers and employees?
Yeah, so Megan, part of the problem is that employers have to be careful in the message they're sending to their employees. So legally, employers are allowed to monitor their employees in this situation. Domino's is legally allowed to monitor how its pizzas are being made. But they've also got to worry about, am I creating distrust between my employees and our supervisors? Am I creating a good work environment for my employees? And these are the balances they have to weigh, despite the fact that legally they're on solid ground for what they're doing.
Well, that was going to be my question, because I think most employers, and a lot of it is in your employee handbooks, that yes, they can, if you're using company equipment, for instance, for emails, they can monitor that. It all goes through their system. I mean, I guess from that perspective, how do they balance the right that they have to make sure that their company resources are being used wisely with your right as an individual to kind of know what is being monitored?
Well, the advice we give a lot of our employers whenever we're discussing this issue is that you've got to be upfront and over-disclose this information. Being transparent about what you were doing, how you were monitoring your employees, is really the best way to try and address this issue with your team, because, you know, wedging it in between boilerplate language and an employee handbook, yes, legally you did what you were required to do, but is that really helping your employee understand the full depth of how he or she is being surveilled? That's what the problem is. And so really trying to address that up front is the first big part. The other part is making sure that the surveillance and the monitoring you're doing is actually targeting the end goal or the result you're trying to produce. So with Domino's, I would argue that this is probably one of the better surveillance measures that I've seen employers use that actually is specifically targeted at, let's make sure this pizza is done correctly so that our end user or customer is happy. There's a lot of other companies that are doing some very invasive biometric monitoring where you've got heat sensors at desks that are monitoring whether or how long an employee is sitting at his or her desk. And the problem there is, well, okay, is that really monitoring productivity? Somebody could be online shopping at their desk, and that's not really targeting the problem that you're trying to fix.
Well, in another concern that I would think we would have in this day and age where a lot of things are being saved on computers, saved on networks, possibly saved on the cloud, is the possibility of this kind of information getting outside of a company because of cyber criminals.
I think that's a very valid concern. You've got so many data breaches that are going on with consumer data that we hear about all the time in the news. But it's on these smaller scales with these other companies. If you've got, let's say, video camera footage, or you've got certain personal data that has been obtained through workplace surveillance, well, then the employer at that point probably has some liability if their system is hacked and that data gets out.
What kind of right does an employee have to know, for example, if artificial intelligence is being used, what is it measuring? I mean, does the employee have the right to ask that?
The employee has the right to ask it. Whether or not the employer has to actually answer the question is kind of a gray area, to be completely honest. There's not any black and white rules out there about what types of surveillance is allowed. The standard has really been, the most black and white standard has really been, and a company has a right to monitor its equipment and its assets. So if you're using company Wi-Fi, you're using a company phone, a company car, the company and the employer have the right to monitor and protect those things. When it comes to data that's being gathered, like you're talking about, and stored, that really hasn't been tested yet in courts, and there's not really any laws out there addressing it. So that's one of those things that as society and technology changes, it's going to come up at some point, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, and you have to think, too, in a company like Domino's, where someone making a pizza is very likely a minimum wage worker, are they really going to have the resources to try to battle a corporation if something does happen?
Very, very great question there, and also a concern. And that's why there's a lot of federal regulatory agencies like the EEOC, and on the state grounds, you have organizations like the Texas Workforce Commission that are set up for that exact scenario where you've got employees that don't have the financial means to challenge or contest their unemployment or their workers' compensation or other issues or employment discrimination, for example. And so if I had to guess, I would say that as these situations develop with our technology and the rights to privacy and the issues that follow from that, I would believe that we'd probably end up with some other regulatory agencies or administrative agencies through which an employee without means could try and challenge what their rights are against these employers.
Is this another case too, and I think you've kind of alluded to this, where our technology has gotten ahead of our laws?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we see this day in and day out when it comes to surveillance and issues with what are employees' rights in the workplace, because you look at all the different avenues and conduits through which people communicate and all the different ways that you can use the internet to communicate and do other things, and most of the time on a company computer, and there's just a myriad of questions and situations that you can't really account for until they happen. And so I 100% agree that this is where our technology is getting ahead of our legislature.
Well, let's break this down in a couple of ways as far as giving maybe your top recommendations to both companies and employers. Let's start with companies. What are maybe three cautions that you would give companies if they are looking at this type of technology to monitor the workplace?
Well, and I'm going to repeat myself a little bit here, but the number one is be transparent. Let your employees know what you are doing. Number two, make sure that it's narrowly tailored to actually achieve the goal that you want it to achieve. And number three, that kind of goes with number two, constantly go back and reassess what you're monitoring, how you're monitoring it, and whether or not it's effective. Because if you put something into place and you just leave it there and let it kind of go on for months, years, and you don't actually assess, okay, is this really necessary? Is this something that maybe has gone a little too far and maybe makes our employees feel uncomfortable and it's not really achieving our goal? Well, that's a good opportunity to change that up because you're going to create a problem with your company culture.
So then for the employees, what are the questions that they should be asking about how they are under surveillance?
Well, the questions themselves maybe aren't as important. I think it's the timing of when to ask those questions and the certain actions they need to take. So first off, I would say for certain types of industries, recruiters are a pretty heavily used tool for companies trying to hire. I would ask the question of your recruiter, what type of surveillance activities are going on at this company? How much of my privacy am I giving up to go work for this company? In situations where you don't have that, that's a question that you need to assess either during the interview process or when you first get on the job, if you're past that point, and figure out exactly what are the ins and the outs of the surveillance and the monitoring that's going on at this company. And then, of course, read the employee handbook. That's something where that's a place where that information is going to be disclosed. But if you read the handbook by itself without doing the first two things and asking the questions, you're only going to get part of the story. So you really need to gain a full understanding of where am I completely off company property, so to speak, and not being monitored, and in what areas am I actually being watched.
Austin, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Absolutely. Look forward to talking again.
That's Austin Pennington. He's a trial attorney joining us today on KMOX Weekend at Your Service. And up next, we're going to talk about an Illinois town that will start charging a fee for single-use bags. Well, welcome back. This is KMOX Weekend at Your Service. I'm Megan Lynch. Thank you so much for joining us on this Sunday afternoon. A story that you may have heard about this week: you will have to pay if you use paper or plastic at checkout at some stores in Edwardsville, Illinois. The town is the first in the region to implement a fee for single-use bags at stores. Councilman Will Krause joining me now to talk more about it. Councilman, where did the push for this come from?
So the push to create the single-use carryout fee started about 2 years ago with a group of local citizens that formed a movement called Bring Your Own. And they looked around the country at a lot of different states and communities that had began a similar ordinance, which was to institute a 10-cent fee for every plastic and paper bag, or otherwise a single-use bag, at a retail association. And they sort of tested it out in the community. They had town hall meetings. They went to local farmers markets, the Chamber of Commerce, and a variety of other business groups to get feedback from both residents that live in Edwardsville and our small business community. And that's where the beginnings of this ordinance came from.
So let's talk about how this is actually going to work. You mentioned it's a 10-cent fee, and is that per bag that someone would use in one of these retail establishments?
That is correct. If you're a customer and you go to any of our stores that are over 7,000 square feet, so that's going to encompass what we like to call a lot of our big box retailers that you might think of, your Targets or your Kohl's that are here in Edwardsville. If you come without your own reusable bag, you will be assessed a 10-cent fee at the checkout for each plastic or paper bag that you would take. The fee can be avoided simply by bringing your own reusable bag, and then you don't get charged anything. The idea is to nudge individuals in a different consumer spending mindset, and it's been shown to work in other communities. And with our particular system that we have, the fee that is collected stays with the retailer. It does not come back to the city, and that's one of the primary reasons we have the small businesses on board. They can keep that fee with them, and we encourage them to use it either to, you know, offset the cost of implementing this ordinance when it goes into effect April 1st of 2020, and also to purchase reusable bags they can hand out to their patrons when they're at their stores.
Now, have you heard back from any retailers? Are they concerned at all about any consumer backlash for doing this?
So it kind of depends on the size of the retailer. As I mentioned before, the Targets and the Kohl's, the conversations that we've had with them has largely been indifferent, simply because since they're more of a corporate entity, they've had to implement this practice in other communities where they operate at. It was really important for us to ensure that our small local business, our mom-and-pop stores, were not affected. And a part of the reasoning there was, since they are a smaller store, they're not producing the volume of this type of consumer waste that you would see at a large corporate entity. So the smaller mom-and-pops have been exempted, so largely that came out of those workshops that this BYO group had done over the course of 2 years, and they have seemed largely favorable to it. Customers out on the street, you know, that depends. The most comments that I've received have been fairly positive. I'm recently reelected to my position here in the community, and this was one of the items that I pushed for in my election campaign, so at least within my part of the city, it was overwhelmingly accepted and liked. But I'm sure there will be a few people out there that it will take a little bit to change their mindset. But look, we've been using plastic bags in grocery stores for really only the last 30, 35 years. It was a consumer habit that we learned, and I think it's a consumer habit that we can quickly unlearn.
For consumers coming into the community, will there be any signage anywhere to alert them that, yes, you will be charged this 10-cent fee per plastic or paper bag that you use?
Great question. And yes, that was one of the primary things we wanted to have. So when you're parking in a parking lot and you're coming up to one of these businesses that's over 7,000 square feet, because what does that actually mean to a shopper that's on the ground? That's hard to imagine. There's a sign that would be posted on the door storefront, like with a lot of other government signs, no smoking in this building, or you know, you can't bring a firearm into this building. There will be a standardized sign that would be placed there. And then also at the point of sale or at the checkout inside the store, there will be a reminder on the cash register to alert customers that this is a store that will charge a 10-cent fee. So it gives them a heads up prior to coming in. So if you're on your way into the store and you're like, oh, shoot, I forgot my bags, let me go back after my car and grab them, you have those reminders. And the city is going to be working to create that signage, and we're looking to model some of that off of Boulder, Colorado, who has a very good program for the signage.
Now, what about for shoppers who may be on food assistance or other things like that when they go into the grocery store? Does this apply to them as well?
No. So if you're on a state food assistance program, you show your card at the checkout and you're waived. We don't want to impact those that might not have the means to cover that fee. It is still a small fee, but it was important. We heard from that segment of the community, and we heard from some of those representatives that it is important to have this waiver in there for individuals on a food assistance program.
And just to clarify for folks, you mentioned that this was at the checkout, so this doesn't apply to things like the plastic bags you might use in the meat or the produce departments.
No, and that's a very good question, because it's a little confusing when you're out there in the marketplace. Essentially, this is only that standard paper bag or plastic bag. You all kind of recognize it when you see it. They're blowing along the roadsides, or they're, you know, in our ditches or our lakes and streams. It's the ones you get at the checkout. So if you're inside the store, you get your meat from the meat market and they wrap it in a little plastic sheet, that doesn't count. Or if you're at the hardware store and you're picking up some little loose ends, they put them in a small little, like I call them doggy paper bags, those don't count. Anything inside the store is not affected by this. So if you're picking up flowers from a florist and they wrap that in like a saran wrap, that isn't affected either.
Now, you mentioned you didn't want this to impact some of the smaller businesses that you have in Edwardsville, which you do have quite a few. I would think for a lot of those shop local stores that this would be something they would already be encouraging their customers to do. Would you expect maybe to expand this to those stores in the future?
We don't expect to expand it to the smaller retailers in the future. And you have a very good point. A lot of our smaller retailers are kind of already doing this. In fact, some of them were on the steering committee with the Bring Your Own group and provided feedback to it, and were some of the early adopters of a program that the Bring Your Own group started, which was take one, leave one. Essentially, that group set up a bag library, if you will, in some of our small shops. If you came in to, say, a market basket and you forgot your bag at the checkout, well, right by the door, there's a large bin of bags that you can take. So the smaller retailers are sort of already aware of that, and we had a number of them that had began this process on their own of encouraging their patrons to bring reusable bags. I think some of them provide, you know, a discount if they bring that in, or some sort of customer appreciation.
Now, you mentioned that this has been, you know, a couple of year process around the country for communities to implement policies like this. Do you know, have there been any studies or anecdotal reports of how it may have reduced the use of single-use bags?
Oh, yes. So I believe the earliest single-use fee or ban began back in 2011 or right around there. So it's been close to a decade now that this type of ordinance has been working its way across the country. And of course, we've seen a lot of large corporate retailers already begin either phasing out single-use materials or outright removing it from their companies. You know, you have some businesses already doing that, such as Aldi or Sam's Club, that do not have a single-use bag at their checkout point. There are a variety of studies out there that do show that a small fee does remind the consumer, and it does shift their habit to bring a reusable bag, because ultimately what we want to see is we don't want to have retailers having this as a revenue stream. We don't want the city to collect any money from this. We want people to gradually reduce the consumption of this product, because ultimately where this ends up is only 5% of plastic bags in particular are recycled. Ultimately, the majority of them end up either in landfills or out in our environment in some capacity. And also, people think they can be recycled. So if you're at home and you have these bags, they'll put them in their recycling bins. And locally on our side of the river, our waste hauler is Republic Services. And typically, a lot of times, when they end up in the recycle streams at the Republic Services facilities, they're contaminating the other recyclables. So they're getting gummed up in the machines, it slows down their overall recycling and sorting process. So there's a lot of different ways that this small item is affecting our overall waste streams and our environment.
Well, Councilman, thank you so much for your time on this Sunday afternoon. That's Councilman Will Krause joining us on KMOX Weekend at Your Service. Coming up next, we're going to give you a little inspiration as we hear some stories about ordinary people in our region doing extraordinary things. It's 2:41. We're back with KMOX Weekend at Your Service. I'm Megan Lynch. Thank you so much for joining us. We need a little inspiration on this Sunday afternoon with all the crazy stuff that's happening in this world. And this week, KMOX honored ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things. Maria Kina takes us to an off-the-beaten-path warehouse where Christmas dreams are created.
I'm doing my Christmas dreaming.
What do they mean? Where I've had this all filled up before we start bagging. This is our baby section. Every baby gets a bag with three books, a ball, a blanket, and an age-appropriate education toy.
Meet Rita Sweener, founder of Santa's Helpers, an organization that's been providing Christmas and Hanukkah gifts to underprivileged children since 1968.
Where'd you first start?
My home.
I guess you outgrew it.
Yeah. I guess about the 10th year, I kicked everyone out because I was tired. I wanted to go to bed. I get in my room, my bed. I roll over on a scotch tape dispenser and the scissors. And I thought, it's got to go out of my house. It's got to go out. So we had a place in U City, but they sold the building on us. Then we moved to Produce Row. We were above the vegetables. And then we moved above the chickens. And then we moved to 5151 Natural Bridge. We were there 5 years, and then we moved here.
Here is the Dogtown version of the North Pole, nestled away in a warehouse off of Manchester.
When you started this back in 68, what was your motivation? Why'd you do it?
I was president of the Evening College Council at UMSL, and one of my professors, a part-time math professor, asked me if we would sponsor a family. Fell through the cracks. He was the St. Vincent de Paul Society. So I said, sure. 68, I started, kept it up. I had that same family for 3 years.
Rita doesn't celebrate Christmas. She's Jewish, a psychologist and professor who had her own practice.
I worked two jobs most of my life, and when I first started this for the first, I guess, 20 years, one of my paychecks went strictly to Santa's Helpers. But it wasn't this big. We were doing like 12, 15 families.
Yeah.
I worked in East St. Louis State Community College, so we would do 15 East St. Louis families. And Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, we would do 10 or 15 St. Louis families.
Rita is now in the warehouse and doesn't get to make Christmas Day deliveries.
But I do Christmas in July myself. I deliver all those. Our Santa's all volunteer who deliver this. They all come back thanking us for allow them to deliver. And once they do it, they're hooked forever.
Rita never forgot where she came
from. As a child, I struggled. I lived in the slums of Pittsburgh, so I always know what it's like not to be valued. The first year we did Christmas in July, and a social worker had the families in line, come one family at a time, see Santa, get their gifts, then go over, pick out an outfit, and then pick out some shoes. One little girl, around 9, 10 years old, you're going to go in there, Santa's going to call your name and give you gifts. And that little girl looked at her defiantly and said, Santa don't know my name. I'm nobody. I'm homeless. And the social worker convinced her she was somebody. She came in the room. Santa called her name. She grabbed the toy. She ran to the social worker with the biggest smile, yelling, you're right, I'm a somebody.
And Rita Sweener is somebody who has made sure for 50 plus years the less fortunate have something come Christmas morning. Maria Kina, St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Ah, Maria, thank you for telling us about Rita. We've got more ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Michael Calhoun tells us about the Missouri Library Association's Outstanding Librarian of 2019 and what her branch is doing to plant roots in the community.
Libraries are one of the few places that anyone is welcome. You don't have to buy anything.
Gina Sheridan runs the Lewis and Clark branch of the St. Louis County Library, smack dab in the middle of North County's Moline Acres, surrounded by homes and vacant stores.
We have a lot of patrons that come on foot. And so if that building was not there, I don't know where a lot of these kids and adults would go throughout the day. It is definitely a community center.
Sheridan says her bosses put her up for Librarian of the Year because she's been innovating with what a library can do and be for its neighbors.
People are interested in health-based initiatives. They want to get healthy. They, you know, maybe can't afford to go to yoga classes. And so we have yoga, we have different nutrition classes, Our local grocery store closed down the street, so we invited the St. Louis Metro Market to come and have a stop there once a week, and it is one of the busiest stops in St. Louis.
And there's a surprising partnership with the St. Louis Diaper Bank.
We are a site for parents to come and get an emergency supply of diapers. So it's, you know, when you're choosing between getting food or diapers, you can come to the library and get a one-time supply and then a referral to an organization that that provides long-term help.
All of this might not sound very bookish, but Sheridan says they manage to fit reading into just about everything they do.
What we're promoting is not only like bring your baby to lap time and story time, but during diaper time is a really good time to talk to your child and bond with your child and really just kind of improve some of the literacy skills of the baby and things like that. So there are a lot of little surprises with our kind of unique programs that do have something to do with literacy still.
Ask Sheridan. She'll say she's surrounded by extraordinary people, not just her coworkers too. Turns out imagination is contagious.
Not too long ago, I got a little handwritten list from a 7-year-old who wanted to have a series of programs. So she had them all listed. It was coloring club, field trip day, movie night with snacks, and she had it all figured out. And she told me that she would take care of marketing and I didn't have to do a thing. And I just thought that was the most wonderful surprise. And it just really made our day.
The Lewis and Clark Library also offered summer lunches for kids 5 days a week, which Sheridan paired with games like chess. Gina Sheridan, an ordinary person doing extraordinary things. Michael Calhoun, St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
And we have time to fit one more of these stories in because I think we need as much positive news as we can get. Debbie Monterey got a chance to talk to the co-founder of a group called Surgical Outreach for the Americas, or SOFA, about the St. Louis organization that's changing and saving lives in Central America.
You never know when an experience or a conversation will change your life or the lives of others. For Peggy Frisella, a nurse who manages research operations for the Department of Surgery at Washington University School of Medicine, it was a conversation about a medical mission. Peggy had taken her daughters to Guatemala, a place she had lived as a young nurse, for their junior service project. Dr. Brent Matthews, who had done a medical mission in Haiti, asked her about the experience.
Medical missions are great, but some of these short-term missions don't yield the results that you really want to have because you go to a small rural community, you see patients day in and day out, you prescribe medications for their ailments, and then you leave, never to see these people again, and there's no follow-up.
That's when Dr. Matthews, who specializes in hernia surgery, suggested doing surgical missions.
So we did our first mission to the Dominican Republic in January of 2009 and saw 65 patients and repaired 65 hernias. It was unbelievable. In 1 week, in 5 days, we were able to do that much good for that many people.
They've expanded to clinics in El Salvador and Honduras.
All of those patients had chronic problems. If you would talk to them, they would say, oh, I've had my hernia for 20 years, or I've had my hernia all my life, or I'm in constant pain.
Frisella says hernias are fairly common in Central America because people work very hard, physical labor, and many have little access to medical care. Surgical Outreach, or SOFA, has grown over the years.
We are operating in 3 countries. We've done over 1,300 surgeries. We're looking at that 4th site in Belize.
And it's not just doing the surgeries. SOFA has another mission.
We also train local people in the countries where we now serve. And our goal is to not have to ever come back. Maybe one day these surgeons can take these surgeries over and we won't have to return.
SOFA operates on a shoestring. No one gets paid. They have a trivia night once a year, and she applies for grants. She uses all of her vacation time for the medical missions, and when she can't, she organizes them from here. So why does she do it?
If you would just take one of these trips and see the change that you can make in a patient, it's life-altering. And once you cross that threshold, there's just no going back. You'll do anything that you can do to help a patient in need.
She hopes to bring her grandchildren on these surgical missions someday and maybe raise enough money to operate from a position of strength. She doesn't want SOFA to get too big, but to focus on doing what they do best. That's Peggy Frisella, Surgical Outreach for the Americas, operating out of St. Louis, Missouri.
And that's Debbie Monterey. Debbie, thank you, as well as Maria Kina and Michael Calhoun, for bringing us some inspiring stories this week of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And if you missed the interview that Brian Kelly did with a reverend in Granite City about the work they do there, you can catch that on our podcast page on KMOX.com. Now, also, if you missed any of today's program or you just want to listen back, we've got a great new feature on our radio.com app. It's called radio.com Rewind. I guess it's kind of like a DVR for radio. And you can skim back and listen to the things we've done. I would encourage you to check out the youth suicide interview with Tina Meyer, the founder of the Megan Meyer Foundation. That was in the 1 o'clock hour. And of course, this hour, we talked about fees for single use bags in Edwardsville and artificial intelligence surveillance in the workplace. Well, coming up next, we've got CBS News, KMOX News, and then we've got The Money Show with Mike Brown. We appreciate you joining us on this Sunday afternoon. We're looking for sunny skies today, a high of 68. Right now, we've got mostly cloudy, 63 degrees in St. Louis.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go. Alvarez ties the game.
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.